Hey everyone, this is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome back to the Device Talks weekly podcast. We're going to begin profiling some of the speakers we'll have at Device Talks West. In this episode, you'll hear from Dr. Ray Baker. He is Vice President and Chief Medical Officer of Neuromodulation at Boston Scientific. He'll be appearing on a panel on October 17th in the morning with Mary Haley. She is Vice President of Health Economics and Reimbursement at Boston Scientific. So it's a conversation that's going to center around the clinical need, the commercial rollout, and the sort of the financial execution that goes in putting together, executing, and again, making commercial a product like Intracept, which is the product we'll be talking about today, the procedure we'll be talking about today. Boston Scientific acquired Intracept when it acquired Relievant, and now it's part of Boston Scientific's pain portfolio. So it's a fascinating procedure, one that is providing relief to many, and Dr. Baker will explain how and why it's significant, why it's different, what is a valuable piece of information in diagnosing the vertebrogenic pain or the vertebrogenic pain. I had trouble saying it in the interview too, and I'm probably carrying that over. So enjoy the conversation with Dr. Ray Baker. And of course, join us at Device Talks West on October 16th and 17th. We'll hear from the fine folks at Boston Scientific and much more, Abbott, Baxter, Medtronic. I could go on and on. We'll be focusing on surgical robotics, interventional tools, neurotechnology. And again, we'll be highlighting some of those speakers in the upcoming episodes of Device Talks Weekly, so you know exactly who will be there. So join us there, and when you register, go to west.devicetalks.com to register and use the code DTPOD25 to save 25% off the cost of registration. So you save yourself a couple $100, and you'll get to hear from many, many leaders from the medical device industry, and you'll have a good time to boot. We have fun at Device Talks, and I'm looking forward to seeing everybody there. Before we roll into this episode of the Device Talks Weekly podcast, I wanted to invite you to our Connected Health virtual conference next week. It's a four-part conference that's going to be running over Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. You can go to devicetalks.com to check it out. It's sponsored by S3 Connected Health and Maxon, and we'll be speaking with leaders from Adana Medical, from Canary Medical, from Baxter, and BD. Kayleen Brown and I will both be leading up those sessions. We'll actually be on the West Coast doing that because we'll be at the MedTech Vision Conference on Tuesday. But really looking forward to learning from these startups and these larger companies about where Connected Health is headed. And again, sponsored by S3 Connected Health and Maxon. Thank you to both of them for their support of Connected Health. They make it possible for you to attend for free. You can just register and watch each episode. You can watch it live and you can watch it on demand. It's up to you. We'll be taking questions from the audience, so make sure you check it out. Go to devicetalks.com to register. I would just register, and hopefully you can be part of the free presentation, or again, you can watch it at your leisure and take in the feedback and the questions from others who were asking questions live. So we did the surgical robotics conference, virtual conference in March. That was a huge success. So we're doing it again and focusing on connected health. So I do hope you'll take the time to sign up for that again at devicetalks.com. All right. With that, let us get this podcast started. All right. You ready for this?
Ready.
Sir?
Doing well, Tom. Doing well. Well rested.
Ah, glad to hear. That's right. You were on vacation last week?
On vacation. Well, hey, actually, I wouldn't say well rested. It was It was a family road trip. I mean, fun trip with little kids, but, you know, good time. Like, drove a...
Wally World?
Yeah, that's right. I had to make John I had to force John Candy to eat a lettuce into the park. I was like, no, no. Went to Northern Michigan, which was actually just beautiful. Actually,
I hear it's lovely. I'm sure I would love it. Being a New England guy, I'm sure it would feel very familiar and very leafy and green.
It was, yeah. A lot of maple forests, like up on the Upper Peninsula, like all that maple and the.
It's funny you should mention maple. Listen, people are going to be like, "Oh, these guys clearly talked before the call." But I was getting coffee yesterday at Aroma Joe's, which is a local coffee joint.
Put a little maple syrup in it.
They had an advertisement for a maple drink, and it got me thinking. Like, I got excited by the maple. Am I being unfair to pumpkin? Like, why is maple? Why do I like maple and not pumpkin?
I mean, maple's delicious. Yeah, maybe it's your New England, like, oh, I'm surrounded. And
maybe it's as simple as that.
Like, and do you ever feel like you want to eat acorns, too, with the oaks you got around there? Like, I want to – maybe I could boil acorns and make myself a porridge or something.
I was trying to draw some deeper meaning as to why I don't like pumpkin, but I do like maple. And you just, Chris Newmark, you went right at it. Like, maple tastes good, goddammit. Like, good, it's delicious. Yeah.
Pumpkin, you might need maple to make the pumpkin taste good.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Yeah, yeah. Some maple syrup on pumpkin squash is delicious. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. I might – false comment. If I see that at the farmer's market, I might have to
– And maple sausages are delicious.
Mm. Like, for breakfast. I'm going to sausages. Now, let's not do that to people. But here. Tom, I got something else fun though. So
okay,
we did the whole road trip. We kept the kids off the electronic tablets. We did
just shut
it.
Up.
We did
in the car.
And one of the big things we did with it was we played a game like find as many license plates from different states as you can, and we got it to 43.
God, that sounds awful.
So driving between Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, and back, what do you think the seven states were that we
– Oh, interesting.
Like, which I don't have an exact – I have the list here of all – I have this list that all we right. – like my wife Kelly was writing all the states as we were driving.
All right. Hawaii would be one.
Hawaii. We found Hawaii. We were driving back into the Twin Cities on the way back and saw Hawaii.
That always befuddles me. How does someone have a Hawaii plate? Like,
I looked it up. It sounds like, especially people in the military, they like to take their cars back, and there's like boats you can put your car on that will ship your car back.
Yeah, I mean, I know physically you can transport your car across water. I'm familiar with ferries and boats that carry that.
Right.
But if I'm living in Hawaii, I'm like, all right, well, I'm going to ship my, like, I'm moving to the States. I'm going to ship my car. I guess.
Why not?
I guess you ship your car.
It's more affordable than buying a new one.
So that's pretty, okay. So let's get back to the practice at hand. So, all right. Well, so Alaska, I mean, I'll go with non-contiguous states, just as a guess.
Alaska, no. We saw Alaska play park somewhere.
Then I don't know if this is going to be a fun game. Is there any rhyme or reason to the states you didn't see?
The biggest thing was, like, the biggest area where the states we didn't see was from New England. We hardly
– Interesting.
We saw a Massachusetts plate or two. Woo-hoo. We saw a New Hampshire plate. But, like, Maine, Connecticut. Rhode Island, you're missing.
All right, well, Maine people won't leave Maine. Rhode Island people,
Maine.
There's only like seven people from Rhode Island. It's a very small state. No
really
one's
hard.
Actually from Connecticut. I think everyone just drives through Connecticut.
No one lives there actually. It's just like those houses I see. Like,
no,
really,
just a prop.
Prop. Okay,
yeah,
cool.
We're gonna get mail. We're gonna get mail.
Yale. Those Yaleys don't have. Do they call them the Yaleys?
I don't know.
Yeah, they're on Connecticut plates. Yeah, they have
that's an interesting point because and this is,
didn't see Idaho either. No Idaho. I mean, so there's just probably five people in that state. Too.
My son's roommate's family is from Illinois, and they I met them when I dropped them off for Purdue, and they had a car, a nice minivan with the stickers of all the places they visited. You know, those black and white stickers with the three letters, and they've driven to a lot of places. And
it
occurred to me, and I told them this, I'm like, you know, it must be nice to be from the middle part of the country because you can go 10 hours this way and 10 hours that way, relatively kind of unblessed and find different things to look at. Whereas in New England, we can go north into Canada. We can go west and do upstate New York. But like if you're driving through New York, New Jersey, like it's just – you're just like, forget about it. I don't even want to bother. Like it's just – we're kind of bottled up by Metro New York City.
Yeah, to go through the whole tri-state.
Well, that's why I think New England people are just like, nah. Why would I go? Why would I go anywhere? I have leafy trees here.
Didn't
like,
see this Vermont is good. Either. No Vermont plates. So
again, and also it's also the nicest part of the year in New England. So
why would you leave
at the time you were traveling? Why would I be in upstate Michigan when I've got it all right here? Interesting.
Yeah, it was really interesting. All right. So, but.
Well, that was fun. And good for you for keeping the kids off screens. I gave up that fight a long time ago. And that's no wonder you're tired, because engaging children for that length of time is just exhausting.
Maybe that's why I feel like I need a rest for my trip. Should have put them on screens, Tom.
give them a Pixar movie, for Christ's sake. Let the kids
chill.
Instead
of, look at the beauty of, like...
It's good to be bored. I always love telling my kids that. It's good to be bored. You should be bored.
We were driving through Wisconsin. I think I must have like about 100 times been like, look, kids, cows. There's cows over there. All right. Anyway, before we just completely annoy our
listeners.
Oh, I'm
sorry. Do we have business too, Jen? That's right.
Well, this is what we do. This is what we get for recording on a Friday. You know, we're just like,
well. 7 minutes of nonsense, you folks. Anyone who sat through this,
we
God bless
sorry,
you.
Yeah.
May, yes, let's get to the
may you live a thousand years now that you went through this. All right. The New Markers newsmakers for the week. New Markers back to this newsmaker. So number 5 on the list, over at NovaCure, they've got a
New England company. Woo!
Yep.
New Hampshire.
Here we go. Cancer treatment tech company. They announced that they're a CEO transition. Their CEO is going to be stepping down. At the start of the year, their CFO Ashley Cordova is going to be moving up into the corner office over there. And I just did a quick check of our big 100 companies, and like roughly, I mean, right now, like only roughly a handful of the 100 largest medical device companies in the world have CEOs who are women. So I guess that's good news. We got one more CEO then.
Good news.
I mean, now just
company is close to $2 billion market cap. So it's not a giant, but a sizable company. Yeah. And Chris Newmarker, I hopped on her LinkedIn profile and her background. She had what was interesting, and you may recall a couple of years ago, our company gave us the Therabody massaging devices. You know, the thing that kind of like she is on the board of Therabody.
Nice.
So I saw that. Yeah, I'm like, well done. We've bought several more Therabody devices since we got that freebie because they're so darn. They do a great job.
We still use it sometimes. Yeah, I mean, it's good. Yeah, you're like, oh, I got a sore shoulder. I can
it's
good.
It gets in there. I don't use it frequently. My wife uses it more. I'm not a big, but when you need it, man, it gets in there. So
good deal.
Made gifts to the in-laws. So yes, she is. She's on the board of
this
Therabody.
This podcast brought to you by Therabody. No.
I'm using it. I use this device.
I use this device.
They're not paying. Therabody is not reimbursed us.
Oh my gosh.
For
yes,
this.
No Therabody coin has changed hands here. So.
And thank you to our employer, WTWH yes, Media, for the Therabody device we received 2 or 3 years ago.
It's very cool.
During the depths of
very
COVID.
Nice.
It was very uplifting.
Yeah, it was a nice care package to get in the day, along with the blanket. And it was great. Anyway, yeah,
that's right.
Like nice,
it was a very nice,
nice
package.
Blanket. It was good. All right.
All right. Well, congratulations to NovaCure and to Ashley Cordova, the new CEO. And hopefully maybe we'll have her at Device Talks. We've had NovaCure at Device Talks before and would love to have them back.
The company gave us a deck of cards back then too. I'm glad I don't have to use that much anymore. So
Number four
on the list. We have Medtronic reported positive long-term data for their extravascular implantable cardioverter defibrillator, the Aurora EV-ICD system. This is really really cool technology because it's providing what the company describes as like safe and effective pacing for ventricular tachycardia, but it's able to provide that pacing with without running leads through transvascular fashion. The company says that it has like the similar size, shape, longevity, traditional transvenous ICDs, but you don't get the risks associated with transvenous ICDs. So you can provide that pacing without having to run the leads in a transvenous way. So, I mean, that's great. And, you know, now they've got some positive long-term data to further back it up.
That's fantastic. And as a coincidence, I think last year we got an extravascular implantable cardioverter defibrillator for Christmas from No, they didn't give us free defibrillators.
No, we're going to get that. In case you need it.
It would be quite an omen to get that.
Go into your cardiologist, like, I brought my own. It's like going to the car mechanic and saying, like, can I buy my own parts? Like, here's my own extravascular ICD. I brought it. Like, here, can you hook me up with this? Like, it's sterile. It's
great news for Medtronic. Yes. And for the people who will ultimately benefit. And I wanted to make a point of identifying the authors of each article. So senior editor, yes, Daniel Kirsch wrote the NovaCure article. And this one is by associate editor Sean Hooley.
Yeah. You know, Danielle and Sean do, you know, like along with me, we do a lot of work on Mass Device. And, you know, and this was a cool story for Danielle to put out about NovaCure, you know, like especially with all the work she does on our like exciting women in medtech project, which, you know, the print edition of Women MedTech, you know, next month. So, you know, keep your eyes out for it. So
we won't say who, but we've got a great interview for the
very excited
Jim Hammer. All right,
number three on the list. So we've got also written by Sean Hooley. We've got a judge in Delaware. This was out on news reports that we caught, saying that J&J needs to pay $1 billion in damages to people who are shareholders of Auris Health, the surgical robotics company they acquired for $3.4 billion in February 2019. And this lawsuit was brought by Fortis Advisors on behalf of those Auris shareholders. But they were the general gist of the argument was that, you know, they were, you know, due milestone mm-hmm. payments. And then, you know, the way that J&J handled those milestones after the acquisition just kind of messed everything up. So, I mean, it was basically alleging that, J&J didn't, you know, handle that post-acquisition process correctly. I noticed that, you know, Joe Mullings of the mm-hmm. Mullings Group, really great, great source for us. I mean, he's helped out a lot with Device Talks. I mean, you know, I've noticed him on LinkedIn. Like, he's had some pretty insightful posts, like, you know, saying this is kind of a big deal. It's going to make look at the way they handle milestones better.
That, and also I think with the whole surgical robotics program, and I think Joe's put forth that, and I think it's mentioned in the suit as well, that Auris, you know, had another soft tissue, like the Monarch was the primary product that they bought, but they also had a soft tissue platform that perhaps some in J&J saw as a better alternative to what Verb was developing, and it sort of, I think, played into
they had that partnership with Google with Verb,
I think maybe added another some more mud to the waters as to the direction that J&J was going to go with its surgical robotics program. It's obviously settled on Ottava now. So, but
when I was first covering the lawsuit, the lawsuit alleged that there was some kind of bake-off of Johnson & Johnson, and that was kind of what got everything in trouble over there. That's their side of the story, but yeah, that's
it's an interesting suit by the Auris shareholders. It's not uncommon for sellers of a company to believe that the acquiring company didn't do what needed to be done to help those milestones be achieved. They usually don't result in lawsuits, at least as far as we know. But this is for $1 billion, which is obviously a lot of money. Very often those payouts are going to be a lot less than that. But there was a deal recently. We don't need to bring the name into it, but you know, the upfront payment was about $1 billion, but there's a potential for another 800,000 with these milestones, and that's where it's the milestones that you aren't sure are ever going to happen, because it's really in the hands of the acquiring company to make sure to do what needs to be done to make it happen. And obviously, it's in their best interest to I think, make a company or make an acquired product as productive as possible, and to get it out in the market and to get it to be a successful commercial launch. But big companies can be complicated, and sometimes they don't follow through on things. So,
and meanwhile, like, everything that came out of this was like this Atava project to J&J, and J&J says they're still with it, but you know, it's still sticking with Atava. But you know, at the same time, you know, Da Vinci now has a next generation surgical robotic system out. You know, the Da Vinci 5.
Yeah, no, it's good. It'll be
Medtronic's got their Hugo out, so like, you know, like it'll kind of watching to see what happens with Johnson & Johnson. Like, are they going to? They say they're going to stick with those.
I think they will at this point, but they certainly at the time of this acquisition, they had the work with Verb that's kind of been put aside, and then they had the Aura, so they definitely had a lot of pots on the stove. But I don't think they can move off of Atava now, nor do I think they should. I'm not sure if they should. I don't think they should. But there is a long road to go. I think they're looking at potentially getting that on the market 5 or 6 years. So I mean, DaVinci's already in a full sprint. So how much territory do you have to make up for in those 5 or 6 years? And then you have OUS players like SSI Innovations and Renovo that are really kind of eating up the OUS market. So it's going to be interesting 5 years to talk. And actually,
very interesting.
We'll have Joe Mullings and Steve Bell on a Device Talks Tuesdays webinar at the end of the year in late December to kind of recap the this interesting year of surgical robotics. So I'm sure we'll be talking about this.
Oh, that'll be fantastic. I mean, it's just such an overall, it's just a really exciting space right now. Just so much news. It's unbelievable.
So much news. You're right. And so many players. I mean, we'll have a lot of this is a self-promotion alert, but Device Talks West will have seven or eight surgical robotics companies represented, soft tissue included, of course, but some that are presenting different ways of doing things. We'll have virtual incision there, but we'll also have companies that are using robotics as in exoskeletons. We've got Andromeda Surgical, which is kind of putting forth an autonomous surgical robotic idea. And this is Nick Damiano, who is he's a former co-founder and CEO of Venflow, who's moved on to this. We'll have him or someone from the company presenting there. So there's not only a lot of surgical, like soft tissue surgical robotics competition that we talked about earlier, but robotics is just finding its way into neurovascular, into many different other clinical areas of medical devices. So it's super exciting. Let's roll on to number two.
All right.
Ooh, big news.
Next up, big news. The
big
MedTech
100.
The big 100. Yeah, it's out. It is out. You can go to Medical Design Outsourcing and read the entire latest MedTech Big 100 report. A huge annual project like that. That senior editor Daniel Kirsch, myself, managing editor Jim Hammer, and we do this annually, and going through annual reports, reaching out to all the companies, collecting all this data on annual revenue, R&D spending, headcount, CEOs, key leaders, headquarters locations, and descriptions of what's been going on with each of these companies over the past year. So if you want to dip your toe into it, like, I've got an article on Mass Device, the 10 largest medical device companies. We're running down that top 10 list. Medtronic's still at the top, but I mean, Johnson & Johnson, their revenue's been growing faster, and they're now like just $2 billion behind Medtronic, and their MedTech business is just $2 billion behind in annual revenue. So we'll have
to
see.
They're growing. We'll have Nick West of Stockwave at Device Talks West, another little self-promotion alert.
Shockwave getting acquired. Yep. So, I mean, we'll
watch out, Medtronic.
We might, there'll be some fun suspense for next year. Like, will Medtronic stay at the top, or will we have Johnson & Johnson MedTech heading up there? So, we'll have to keep an eye on that. So,
I can't wait to see if that, and I'm not rooting for either company, but if there were a new number one, I can imagine the cover possibilities for the next big 100 issue. Of a new number one, it's the crowning of a new king.
And we had some other companies move up in that top 10 list as well, you know, like Stryker, Abbott. Like so some companies, there are some companies out there that moved up. So you should, yeah, people should check it out.
All right, Chris Newmarker, what is number one on our award-winning vaunted Newmarker's Newsmakers list?
Number one on the list is Jim Hammerhan had a scoop for us earlier this week of global layoffs starting at Edwards Life Sciences. Jim had had an announcement that that Edwards CEO sent out that made the announcement of that 3% of the company's workforce will be affected, and this came on the heels of the closing of Edwards' sale of its critical care business. Which had 4,500 employees, about 20% of global Edwards workforce. That's moving to BD now, and now they're doing additional tightening over at Edwards.
All right. Well, I mean, the focus on structural heart certainly is a bold move by Edwards, and I guess it would kind of tie your cart to one particular horse. It's a sizable horse, and it only makes sense that I guess there would be some right sizing from this, from this sort of realignment and refocus.
Probably about 540 jobs. So.
Yeah, and not to be cavalier about the folks who have lost their jobs. Obviously there are other growing companies out there, so I hope they find employment soon. But it's not an easy process to go through. We certainly talked about it too much on this podcast.
We were discussing Edwards, another recent one of these Newmarker's Newsmakers, and their second quarter sales were lower than expected, and the analyst at the time had an interesting comment that it appeared that at least for now that Edwards is new. That the growth of like new structural heart therapies were putting pressure on hospital, workflows. It's kind of like what management was saying at the time. So kind of like the growth of these new therapies are kind of having an impact on TAVR, at least for now. So they're kind of like working through some stuff with that right now. Definitely they're just really trying to focus the company on structural hearts. So, you're focusing the company,
they're making acquisitions of new products. Sorry to interrupt you, but they're growing terrible. That way as well. So
buying Genevalve, buying many other companies.
Don't want to be cavalier about the folks who lost their jobs. We're sorry for them, but we'll see where this the long term vision for Edwards and structural heart how that plays out.
Yeah, so we'll definitely be following this. So, yeah.
All right. Well, that was a murderer's row of newsmakers, Chris Newmarker.
Happy week to deliver.
All right. Well, Chris Newmarker, always a pleasure. Have a great day.
Always a pleasure, man. Enjoy the beginning of the fall season. So
yeah, I'm gonna go get me some maple something.
Go get your maple drink.
It's delicious. It's just delicious.
This is Tom Salami of Device Talks. We're excited to bring you another great program for Device Talks West here at the Santa Clara Convention Center, talking new business models, new missions, and new intentions. I can't wait until we fill this auditorium with MedTech's best engineers, entrepreneurs, and executives. This is Device Talks West.
The foundation of connected care is the who we are that drives the what we do. We shape our environment, and then our environment shapes us.
Thoughtful discussions of how it impacts not only markets, but society and the workforce.
What is it doing for the patient? And that's what our technology needs to be.
I look at what the standard of care is today. Are there areas where we can improve upon the standard of care, or are there areas where there are significant gaps? And that's what drives me.
What am I trying to accomplish? Getting back to that core, what problem am I trying to solve? Am I going to do something new and really move the needle for patient outcomes? So there's a ton of work to be done, and that's what keeps me excited.
Why did you choose MedTech? Find out at Device Talks West on October 16th and 17th. Register at west.devicetalks.com.
The folks that are saving lives, they're all here.
Well, Ray Baker, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me join you today.
It's a pleasure to have you. Relievant's a company that we've been tracking for a long time. And of course, I got to know Boston Scientific particularly well with our podcast we've done with them. So this is a good marriage for us to sort of track and want to learn more about the Intercept system, which of course we'll also be talking about at Device Talks West. You'll be a panelist at Device Talks West on October 17th, I believe. So if folks want a close-up conversation with you, that's the best place to go. But before we get into all the good tech talk, I'd love to learn about our guests. So, Ray, how did you find your way into medicine? What drew you there?
You know, in college, I was kind of going back and forth about between engineering and medicine. And as I took my courses, I was drawn more and more into the idea that I could help people in a career in medicine. And I think the people attracted me, my early volunteer work and things just sort of turned up that volume of interest in medicine. And it just took off from there.
And how did you settle upon spine as a specialty?
Yeah, so it's funny how careers take a path. I was originally an anesthesiologist. I had a background with OB anesthesia and interventional pain as my areas of focus and fellowships. And as I went into practice, I really didn't expect to go into interventional pain full time. But the group I joined had a need for someone to do that. And mm-hmm. since I was the person with the training, they kind of leaned on me. And that was pretty early, right? You're looking at the early days of interventional pain in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. After I went into interventional pain, I realized that I as an anesthesiologist needed to improve my skill set. I needed to understand how to examine the patient, how to read imaging, how to think like a spine physician. So that began a journey for me of seeking out people who could help me, of physiatrists and surgeons to fill in those blanks. So it's been a fun ride.
And what is the spine industry like? You were president at NASS for a year and 1 month. What is that community like? NASS, I think, is a pretty lively clinical meeting as they go. And as specialties go, I think spines, in fact, had a conversation recently with a couple of executives on this podcast, and I kind of call the spine like the wild west sort of med tech. There's still a lot of innovation going on, a lot of developing, a lot of, I think, forward-thinking testing going on. It seems to be still forming it as a specialty. Is that how you see it as well?
I see it as an exciting time in spine, I think, you know, and you can liken it to the days of cardiothoracic surgery and cardiology, you know, when more minimally invasive or percutaneous procedures were developed, there was a shift in that field. Mm-hmm. And I believe it's a improvement in technology that's helping to drive that, but it's also, I think, an improvement in the teaching and education of physicians to allow them to use those tools. So, yeah, it's an exciting time to be in spine.
And how about on the patient side of things? Is there a change in feelings toward spine treatments? I mean, they're becoming more plentiful, I think, more like Intercept, we'll talk about a little bit, I think more attractive and more beneficial is the conversations that physicians have with patients in need of assistance to ease pain or some other malady related to spine. Are those conversations becoming easier?
Yeah, I think so. A surprise to me, I think, in my career as I went on, is I think I always had a feeling that the patients would be looking at surgery as the ultimate fix. And my time spent with patients, I realized that they all wanted to avoid surgery. Mm-hmm. And it's not because the surgeons were bad or their outcomes were bad. It was just because they didn't view that as an early option, right? Which is they're saying, no, I don't want surgery. I want to put that off. So I think there's a desire among patients always to do things that are less invasive. And I think as we've moved on in spine in particular, the evidence base has improved. And so we're starting to develop data that helps to bring confidence for the patients that we're able to help them with a minimally invasive or percutaneous technique and do it safely. So,
interesting. So let's talk about your move to Relievant. You joined Relievant a little over 7 years ago. What was appealing about that opportunity? And was this your first role in industry?
It was my first role in industry. However, I had been with the company as a consultant dating back to 2006, since their very origin. I consulted with a number of companies early on, and one of them was Johnson & Johnson, who owned the technology, the patents, and they spun that off to Relievant. And I followed those patents, if you will, and was a consultant for Relievant back in the early days. But I followed the company, I followed the technology. Initially, I was a skeptic, to be honest with you, right? Because there's a lot of devices in spine that sort of overpromise and underdeliver. And I was skeptical that this was going to be you know the new mousetrap, right? But what won me over really was the basic science, and then the clinical data. So that by 2017, when I looked at, is there, you know, the executive team that I can believe in? Is there a product I can believe in? Is the basic science and the data there? It checked all the boxes. And at that point in my career, I said, this is a logical next step for me.
Let's talk about the problem first or the solution. Let's talk about the problem first. This is directed toward vertebrogenic. Am I saying that right? Pain. I read it and then I'm like, oh shoot, I didn't understand how to say it. For vertebrogenic or genic? Or am I mangling it entirely?
No, you are saying it perfectly. Vertebrogenic pain. It's a mouthful.
All right. It's not that bad, but once I looked at it, I didn't know where that E wanted to go. So talk a bit about how does this become a problem? What is the physical collapse or what happens in the body to create vertebrogenic pain?
Yeah, I think I'll start with the fact that we always knew there was an unmet need. We always knew that there was a missing piece to the puzzle of back pain. You know, we focused on the disc as being the primary cause of pain for many, many years. But we knew that despite, you know, injecting it, ablating it, fusing it, replacing it, doing everything to it, there was a lot of patients who really did not get benefit. And so we scratched our head and we said, there's something wrong with this model. But while we focused on the disc, we ignored the bony end plate on each side of the disc. And that's the place where the disc essentially attaches to the vertebrae. And the basic science that was developed is quite robust around the fact that the same forces that result in the degeneration of the disc also degenerate the end plate adjacent to the disc. So it's sort of one functional unit and they degenerate together. What we found was that the disc actually has very few pain fibers, although we always thought there were more than there are. Indeed, there aren't as many as we thought. But the adjacent end plate, that bone on each side of the disc, is a rich source of pain fibers, much more rich than the disc is. So at that point, we started thinking, you know, wait a minute, have we been looking for pain in all the wrong places, right? Have we been focused on the disc and neglecting the end plate? And the science that came as a result of that inquiry really led to kind of a robust data around how inflammation occurs at the end plate, and that inflammation is sensed as pain. And the changes in imaging that occur as a result of that occur over time because of that inflammation of the end plate.
What is the function of the end plate, and do we have any thought as to why it still has so many pain fibers?
Yeah, the end plate is really where the rubber meets the road, if you will. It's where the disc attaches to the bone. And, and it needs to have two opposing roles. One is to be sturdy, to allow the disc to remain adhered to that bone and to absorb the forces, the shock of everyday living, you know, as you bend, move, twist, jump, run. The other is to allow nutrition to go through that end plate to supply the disc with nutrition, because there is no blood supply to the disc. So because it has two opposing roles, it ends up to be a compromise in terms of function. And it is really the weak link of that system. And those dual roles that are opposing cause it to be vulnerable to damage earlier. And that damage then creates the inflammation that underlies the pain.
Is the pain generated by a physical break of the disc and there's just pressure upon the pain fibers? And that's what's generating the pain as far as we know?
Yeah, it's a little bit of the above. The cracks and breaks in the end plate allow inflammatory material from the disc to seep through those cracks and create inflammation in the bone marrow, in the bone itself.
Okay.
And then as you move, bend, stand, twist, those forces kind of amplify that as you would expect a drum. You know, if you hit a drum, it kind of amplifies that. Mm-hmm. So in the same way, the end plate and the movement kind of amplify that pain that's created by the inflammatory material.
Interesting. And how does the pain present in the person? Is there radiation down the leg? Is it just really pain in the back? What does it feel like?
It presents as pain in the middle of the low back. And,
okay, you know,
in this case, if it's the low back pain, you're kind of pain centered into the low back. It can radiate small amounts into the hip or radiate small amounts into the buttock, but it usually doesn't travel down the leg. It's worse when people sit for a prolonged period of time, worse when people bend forward, worse with activity that, you know, as you can expect, that would amplify that pain. And mm-hmm. since the disc is in the front of the spine, when you bend forward, it creates pressure on that structure. But it's that common back pain that you hear from your friends and relatives and colleagues at dinner, right? Mm-hmm. It's that typical low back pain that people describe.
And does it flare up and go away, or is it consistent?
There isn't a one size fits all. There's some people who have more constant pain, but generally speaking, it waxes and wanes, gets better and worse. But it does, to some extent, always it's there in the background, mm-hmm. and so people will often moderate their activities and stop doing things, which really creates a toll. And that's sort of the personal side of this, mm-hmm. is that patients just stop engaging in life, you know, because as they do, they hurt more and more, and they try the usual remedies without help, and then they just slowly withdraw and isolate.
And just to focus on the pain again, is it a sharp sort of stabbing pain? I'm just trying to understand, or is it more of the muscles seize up in the back kind of pain that you get if you twist the wrong way or run a mile too long or whatever?
Yeah. No, again, it would be lovely to have it be, you know,
I know,
the same way. It is, though, typically, you know, this dull aching pain, but as you yep. move, it can become sharp, you know, when you make a certain movement. The muscles in the back try to protect a structure, and when that structure is inflamed, the muscles will often engage, and that creates a spasm. And so that's why it's a little bit like layers of an onion. You know, on the inside is that end plate that's inflamed, but surrounding that are all the body's ways of trying to compensate for that, like the muscle spasms and other things that we
think. Interesting. God, the back is so interesting. So what leads a person to see a physician to get diagnosed with this, or to see if they do have it, and how is that diagnosis done?
So the traditionally, patients would go in to see a physician, and depending on how bad the pain was, they would seek care from different sorts of physicians, often the lower level pain with chiropractic care, physical therapy. But as the pain accelerated and became worse, or as they didn't get benefit from the other therapies, they would scale up and they'll either see a physiatrist, an interventional pain specialist, mm-hmm. they can see a surgeon. But the issue that we've had leading up to the kind of discovery of the basivertebral vertebral nerve and the work that was done around it was that we didn't have a great way of separating out causes of pain. And that led us to do a trial and error, right? You would start with this therapy, move to that therapy, move to that therapy, but it wasn't necessarily a logical progression. Like, mm-hmm. let's put you on anti-inflammatories. Let's send you to physical therapy. Let's try Pilates. Let's try chiropractic. You know, fill in the blank. One of the things I'm really proud of with the Intracept, or the work around the Intracept system, is that we were able to identify a biomarker that was objective. So when patients get to a certain level and they go to the physician and they can't figure out why they're having pain, they'll get an MRI. And on that MRI, that inflammation that we discussed that occurs in the end plate shows up as something called modic changes. It's a characteristic finding on imaging. And why we're so happy about that is it allows us to identify candidates for the procedure. So it's not trial and error. It becomes more scientific than that. So we're indicated for patients with modic type 1 or modic type 2 at the end plate from L3 to S1, and that's sort of our indications. But when they go to the physician, they're able to identify if they're a candidate.
So are these biomarkers, is the ranking or the rating given by the number of these biomarkers? What is looked at, and how is someone determined to be a type 1 or a type 2?
So the type 1 and type 2 is just a classification of depending how that modic shows up, you know, on the different weighting systems within an imaging and MRI. But it's what we found is the amount of modic isn't as important as the presence of modic, because it's okay. Sort of a binary. Either you have it or you don't. And more modic doesn't mean more pain, and it doesn't make you a better candidate. It just is the presence of that modic is sufficient to allow you. I'll use a short example. My wife underwent the Intracept procedure 4 years ago, and she only had one little bit of modic at one vertebral level on one side. And it was so small that the radiologist refused to call it modic.
Interesting.
And after suffering with 10 years of pain and, you know, restricting her activities more and more and sort of disengaging, she was able to undergo the procedure, has had complete relief, and then re-engage in life, right? Being able to pick up her granddaughter, go and garden, do all the things
that's amazing.
She couldn't do before. So it's it really is a binary biomarker.
Interesting. And it's great to have any data point, I think, in the back. I mean, so much of it is, I remember having back pain about 10 years ago, and I had the MRI done, and one of my discs was ruptured. And I remember the doctor told me, like, look, I could scan everyone in a shopping mall, and like 60% of people could have just as bad as you do, and they're fine. So like, there was no real science to whether this was causing the back pain or not. I didn't ultimately need any kind of procedures, but it was just an eye opener as to how complex the spine is. So let's talk about the solution. It worked on your wife, and I'm glad it did for our sake, for the story, and for your sake as her husband, because I'm sure your life is a lot easier without her suffering like that, and her life is a lot more enjoyable being able to pick up the grandchildren and enjoy life. Let's start to understand what Intracept is and what it does.
So the Intracept system is a way of creating a channel into the vertebral body to access that nerve. The nerve we're talking about, the basal vertebral nerve, runs in the middle of the vertebrae, and its primary function is to supply pain to the end plate. So if we can gain access to that nerve, we can ablate it, or we can lesion it, burn it, and prevent it from transmitting that pain signal. The beauty about the basal vertebral nerve is it loses its ability to regenerate after it enters the bone. So if we can create a large enough lesion in that nerve, we have a treatment that should last ongoing, meaning it should not regenerate, which is the scientific underpinning of why we have 5-year results that are even, you know, are so good. Because once you've ablated that nerve, if it doesn't regenerate, the patient's relief should just continue to persist over time, which we found it does. So the question that arises from that, from patients often is, well, if the nerve is there to to transmit pain, if you burn it or disable it, am I going to hurt myself? Am I going to feel pain, or, you know, am I not going to be able to feel pain? Is something going to happen? And the answer is, we have multiple cases in the body where a nerve is ablated and it does not cause harm, does not, you know, you don't miss that warning sign. And in the case of the vertebrae, there's enough other sort of redundant warning signals that you don't miss that nerve. So we have very robust data on the safety of this procedure out to 5 years, where, you know, we have 99.7%, I think, of patients without any sort of event. So it's really been nice to be able to have a nerve that we can ablate and do it safely and cause a patient to be able to reengage in life again, but without the downsides of harm. So,
how is the channel created, and how is the nerve ablated?
I think the work that needed to be done was in creating a channel in hard bone, because a lot, you know, often the patients are 40, 50 years old, and they have very hard bones. So how do you create a channel safely into the bone and access the back of that bone? And that, it really is the specialized tool set that we developed, allow you to make a curved path through the bone, channel into the back half of that vertebral body where the nerve lives, then place a probe in to essentially create heat and lesion that nerve to prevent it from transmitting the pain.
So can you help me understand how that channel is created? What is the physical force applied that, and what tool is used to create the channel to allow the energy to reach the nerve?
We're able to create a path into the nerve using an introducer that we mallet in through the bone and create a curved channel to the back of that vertebrae where the nerve lives. We then can put a probe in to generate heat and ablate the nerve in the back of the vertebral body.
Mm-hmm. And does it frequently only require one application in a procedure, or do you hit multiple spots in a procedure? I guess it depends upon the patient, of course, but what is a typical procedure look like?
No, it's a good question. Each vertebrae only requires one lesion.
Okay.
But very commonly, the disc will degenerate around two vertebrae. So the most common application of this is in at least two vertebrae that are adjacent to each other. You know, the L4 and L5 vertebrae is an example. We'll often lesion together.
And where is the procedure done typically? I imagine this is something that can be done in a ASC or some lower intensity clinical setting. And what is recovery like?
It is done in an ambulatory setting. It can be done in an ambulatory in an ASC or in a hospital-based ambulatory center. It's a same-day procedure. Procedure takes about an hour, and the recovery is quite rapid. I think patients normally are able to resume activity, full activity in 4 to 6 weeks. They may have modified activity for the first few days, but often they return to work within a day or two after the procedure.
Really interesting. So talk a bit about your Relievant was acquired recently by Boston Scientific. Talk a bit about the integration into the company, and where does Intracept sort of fit into the broader pain portfolio at Boston Scientific in terms of, is this the entry point? Is this a good middle device? Where does it sort of fit into the grander scale of things?
Yeah, we were acquired by Boston Scientific in November of 2023. We were not looking to be acquired at that time, but we knew that if we were going to be acquired, that it would be nice for it to be Boston, meaning that when we looked at the companies, their culture, their ability to innovate, Boston showed the greatest amount of alignment with where we were headed. And since the integration, I think we've only been more and more impressed with the team, you know, everyone from the executive team, down through their commercial team, R&D, clinical, et cetera. I think that the addition of Intracept into the Boston portfolio helps them in their goal to provide the category leadership in pain. When you look at the chronic pain patient or the patient with back pain, it's a complex problem. The pain often will shift over time. There can be more than one source of pain, and the pain will often go from one source to another. So it's not that you have a single source of pain in a patient, you treat it, and they never have pain again. So the idea behind the category leadership is really being able to develop a portfolio of treatments that allow the patient to get the right treatment at the right time. And that means that we need to help them earlier in their journey when they develop some sorts of pain, and we can help them throughout their journey if they develop other sorts of pain, and we can help treat all of those. And it really is nice to be able to see them make commitments as the field grows, this advanced interventional field grows, that Boston is really leading in many ways that effort to embrace these changes and lead in those changes, actually.
That's great. So I know you'll be speaking with Mary Haley, who's the Vice President of Health Economics and Reimbursement at Boston Scientific. So we're talking really about the technology, about the problem, the solution, and about the commercial rollout of a new innovative and helpful medical device. Where are you currently with the rollout or the commercialization? How broad is it out there? And after giving us sort of a sense of where things are headed commercially, just personally, it must be wonderful to kind of have a device that you're helping patients with, including your wife, which must be very rewarding.
Yeah, I'll say that I'm really excited that as we see the adoption of this therapy and you see the widespread support of this therapy, that being able to see as many lives changed as we see, and I hear about it every day from a text or an email. And it's not just my wife's life. It's fun to see the number of physicians who've had this treatment themselves.
Interesting.
Or their relatives or their colleagues or their nurses and other folks. So it's been, that in a way is the highest form of compliment or endorsement. If a physician has the treatment themselves or their family members, you're doing something special. We've seen really nice adoption of the technology. And I think a lot of that is because we spent the time to develop the evidence. And we really took a lot of time and effort to develop not just one randomized controlled trial, but two randomized controlled trials to support the evidence. So that's helped Mary Haley a lot in her efforts with payers and to allow the patients to have access to care. We're still on our journey, but we have over half of the adults in the U.S. are covered with this procedure right now, which is pretty amazing given it's pretty early in its trajectory, if you will. So we've seen nice adoption despite it being fairly early in the adoption curve.
That's great. All right. Well, we look forward to hearing more at Device Talks West. And thanks for joining us today on the podcast.
Tom, thanks for having me. And it's been a pleasure.
All right. Well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. Once again, make sure you join us at Device Talks West. It's happening October 16th and 17th at the Santa Clara Convention Center. Use the code DTPOD25 to save 25% off the price of registration. And of course, join us next week for a virtual discussion on connected health. The series is brought to you by S3 Connected Health and Maxon, and it features speakers from Adana Medical, Canary Medical, Baxter, and BD. So we'll have big company perspectives, small company perspectives, and you'll have the opportunity to ask questions of both. So go to devicetalks.com for details on the speakers and to register. It's free. You can watch it live and you can watch it on demand, or you can watch it on demand. You could watch it live and on demand if you really want to. It's going to be a lot of great information there. So why not watch it twice or three times? Finally, don't forget to register. I'm sorry. Don't forget to follow or subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network. That way you don't miss a future episode that we're putting out on Device Talks. We just rolled out Structural Health Talks. We're going to be putting out a second episode of that next week. And we're rolling out a new podcast in October. And we're working on a couple other very cool projects as well. So lots going on here in podcast land. We want you to be a part of it. And final thing, make sure you connect with me on LinkedIn. Make sure you connect with Chris Neumarker on LinkedIn. Make sure you connect with Kayleen Brown on LinkedIn. And make sure you follow Device Talks. Our Device Talks follower numbers are going up, up, up. We had a record week this week in terms of new followers. So we're grateful to that, but we'd love to have more. And follow Mass Device as well. All right, folks. Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks weekly podcast. Tune in next week. I expect to have a podcast episode for you next week. That's my plan. Lots of travel, but I'm going to do everything I can to make sure we deliver on the weekly part of Device Talks Weekly. Thanks, everybody.